Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Maria Arana, author of Latinoland, a portrait of America's largest and least understood minority. She is the author of several award-winning books, America Chica, Boulevard, and most recently, Silver, Sword, and Stone. She is the inaugural literary director of the Library of Congress and previously served as the books editor of the Washington Post. Arana has devoted her career to exploring Latinos' origins, identities, and histories in the United States. And Marie, welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much, Hopeton. It's so great to be back with you.
Well, Marie, I'm a fan of your work. Obviously, this is the third time that I've interviewed you, so I'm a great fan of your work.
But
one of the things I really enjoyed about this book is the way you took a personal viewpoint on top of the history for writing this book. And one of the reasons that I think that is important is that so often we have that third person narrative where it's almost like they separate themselves from the material, when the material, in my opinion, often the decision you make to cover this material, to write about that material, often has a deeply personal reason. So I'm going to ask you, what was the deeply personal reason that you wanted to write Latinoland?
Oh, thank you for the question. You know, it is absolutely anathema for a historian to write themselves into the story. It is absolutely anathema for a journalist to write themselves into the story. I've written both history and I've written both journalism as well. And in this case, you know, I came to this book after many books trying to explain who we are. And I tried to explain it through biography of great people, through my own memoir, through novels, through a history of Latin America, just to say, this is where we're from. But when it came to writing something which, you know, I finally realized the 64 million people in this country represents a nation within a nation. And we are larger than any Spanish-speaking country, except for Mexico. So, I mean, this was a population that I had to really come and write about. I have been part of it. I have been promoting it, publicizing it, trying to get people to understand who Latin Americans are and who Latinos are. And finally, I realized that I hadn't done the biggest thing, which was to explain who we are here on this land, in this country, and since time immemorial, because we go way back to the American Revolution and before that. So my deeply personal reason, Hopeton, to answer your question, is just seeing that this was the story all the time.
I like the way you open up in your first chapter of the book, Arrivals, about your confusion as a six-year-old in Miami on which bathroom to use, the one that said whites only or the one that said colored. Your mother was white. Your father was Peruvian, colored Peruvian. And there's a reason I say colored Peruvian, going back to the story you tell about the actress who's from Argentina. So talk a little bit about this incredible diversity of communities, of nations, of people that Latin Americans have in their genes. It's not just a one strand type of makeup.
For 500 years or more, there has been racial mixing in Latin America. And you can't find many people, unless it's their tiny little elite group of white people who have intermarried with their cousins so to preserve their race. And that goes, actually, the Inca did that too. The Inca, they married their sisters, the emperors and whatnot, to actually preserve the royal blood. Well, everybody else was race mixing. And we had, of course, the original mix between the Spaniards and the indigenous. But then came this extraordinary infusion of Black Africans, who people, I think, forget or have never understood that the Atlantic slave trade was 12 million people. 1 million of the 12 million died in transit. 350,000 went to the United States. All the rest, which is to say 10 million plus, went to Latin America. So we are very, very heavily infused with African blood. And then, of course, came the Chinese, the Asians, the Japanese, the Koreans. And so we mixed with those. Doing my own DNA, I have every race of man. I have black, I have Asians, I have Chinese blood, I probably have Japanese blood as well, and indigenous, a very heavy dose of indigenous. This was a historic moment in the history of the Earth, of this planet, is that this hemisphere became so race mixed, mostly south of the Rio Grande. Of course, the story in the United States was very different, very, very different. So this, to me, was a natural state. We didn't, the nuanced vision of race in Latin America is so different from the binary in the United States. And I remember coming into the airport as a little kid and seeing those restrooms with labels on them, and I did not know what color I was. And I remember looking down at my skin, sitting in the bathroom and saying, oh, you know what? I had never seen that sort of that racialization. And I think that it makes us uncomfortable to have to put down what race we are, because we end up being a million races, and having to identify one or another is kind of ridiculous for most of us.
Interesting enough, what we have seen at times, I remember I did a book event a few years ago where we had a Dominican writer on a panel, and I do a book event called Diverse Literary Voices of Texas on an annual basis. And one of the things that this Dominican woman revealed was that she was told that she was primarily of African descent by her parents was that she was not black, that she was Dominican. And then I think about the efforts of some of the nations, I believe Mexico, just trying to water down the African blood within the community. I think Mexico, and I hope I'm not wrong on this, just recognizing the black race in Mexico recently.
Right.
So in Latin America, there's been a reluctance in some areas to accept the African blood that's part of the DNA, part of the diversity of Latin America. But I just thought, but you were not afraid to embrace it, not afraid to say this is what it is. And are we seeing, in your opinion, are we seeing sort of a shift where people are more comfortable recognizing that you have indigenous blood, you have European blood, you have African blood, that this is all part of you, and it just accepting it, as opposed to, I remember years ago, moving to Austin in 1992, met a couple, the wife was clearly of African blood, the husband different, but she goes, we say, oh, we got another African-American living here, another black living in this area. And she says, I'm not black, I'm Cuban.
That is so perfect, Houghton. It just is so representative of the way that we feel. I mean, I have so many Dominican friends or Puerto Rican friends who don't know, or know in quotation marks, that they're black until they come to this country. And they're told, they said, okay, you know, you check that box. And they're surprised because, and in many cases, they may have thought they were actually white. Certainly in Peru, which is heavily indigenous, we are an Andean country with very, very strong indigenous past, indigenous roots, and indigenous presence. And I have friends, one very wonderful journalist friend whom I write about in Latinoland, who all for his whole life thought that he was white because he was told, you are white, you are absolutely white, you are criollo, which is the word that we use. It's not like Creole in the Caribbean. It's criollo, means you are straight Spanish blood living in the Americas. And so he lived a whole life believing this, and then gets to about 40 when he realizes, because he's being told, that he's definitely not white. He is brown. He's indigenous. He is has a very strong Peruvian Indian past. And this happens all the time, I think, to Latinos, the being categorized. The U.S. Census, just in the past few years, saw a huge jump in mixed race, sort of checking the more than one race, more than two races box. And that was not because suddenly a whole lot of people of mixed race arrived. It's that a lot of people then were comfortable declaring that they were from many races and not just one.
I'm from Louisiana and New Orleans specifically. And the law in New Orleans was that, going back, was that if you had 3% black blood, that you were considered black, even if you were had 97% other blood. And the interesting thing about that was sort of the marginalization and the oppression of a group of people, whether you had 3% or the 99%. And so this sort of, to some degree, pulled that group together, because whether you had 3% or 99%, you were put in that box and you were oppressed.
Right.
But on the other hand, we see a rise in the embracing of the biraciality, and which embracing all those different elements. But to some degree, I'm wondering, when the whole group is oppressed, no matter what your mix is, you're just oppressed.
Right.
But if you break out separately and saying, I'm different from everybody else, what does that do to the efforts to ensure all those of color have equal rights to fight oppression, to fight all these other issues, when you have some groups and it's their choice that say, I'm not here? It's like in Louisiana, we had, are you black? You're Creole. Growing up in New Orleans, it's a whole Creole black thing that was going on in terms of sort of these separations. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious of what your thoughts are on these groups, the groups that want to separate, in light of the programs, the anti-discrimination laws, are all driven by sort of the binary American color line.
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting point, because you lose your ability to fight or advocate for your rights and your representation. If you don't stick to whatever, sort of political stripe works in the process of arguing for your rights. This is called racial attrition, when the intermarriage becomes so much that the people lose, I mean, children of Latinos, for instance, from an intermarriage, and then they intermarry, because we are the ethnicity that most intermarries in this country. You get to a point where those grandchildren are not feeling a part of that ethnicity or that race anymore. And so that sense of, I've got to fight for my rights and I've got to represent my people, disappears. And that is problematic for those who do not yet feel representative, who are, as you say, oppressed, and need to really fight for and advocate for those rights. So it's an issue. It's an issue very much so in Latinos who lose their language because they don't speak it anymore, because the monolingual thing takes over. They intermarry, and little by little, they lose the feeling of being Hispanic anymore, and they don't declare it. And so there is that kind of watering down of not only the population and the ethnicity, but of the passion to represent your race.
Does it lead to often identifying more with the dominant race, the dominant culture, and less with the culture of your family and your heritage?
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. You know, one thing in Latin America, which is really interesting, is that the one drop rule is the opposite way. If you're part white, you can claim it. You know, and a lot of, and that was sort of the rule in the colonial times with Spain. You could buy whiteness. Could you imagine that in the American context? No. You could actually go and buy whiteness, because indigenous people or colored people were not allowed to be represented in government. They were not allowed to have certain jobs. They were not allowed to be educated, all of those things. But if you paid the Spanish colonial government enough money, they would give you a certificate. And the certificate claimed you were white and you could have the rights of a white. Extraordinary difference from the American context, but that's, you know, the lands from which we've come.
There's a satirical novel that was written by a black journalist in the early 1900s, and the name of the novel is Black No More. And yeah. So the premise of the novel is a scientist invents a machine that can turn you white.
Right.
And so the fun of the novel is no longer can you know if someone is really white or not, because so many blacks in the satirical novel or using this machine to turn white. So I thought that was interesting. And we could talk a little bit about Dave Chappelle.
Right. Yeah. But well, it actually happened in the Spanish colonial context. You paid enough money. Actually, it was to the church. You paid enough money to the church and they would declare you white.
I want to talk about the Variety article that you quoted in the book on Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yes.
And there was an article written where it was celebrating her as a person of color of winning this award. And then they had to step back. And this is education for me, actually. I mean, I always knew Argentina was different. Just, you know, knowing that apparently a lot of the Nazis went to Argentina. But learning the history of how Argentina brought in a lot of white Europeans to basically, I'm making up a word here, whiter-sized the population. And so how Anya Taylor-Joy sort of said, hey, I'm white, I'm from Argentina, but I'm actually white 100%. So talk a little bit about that whole concept, because that was something that I was sort of vaguely aware of on the periphery, knowing a little bit about the history of Argentina, but talk about 100% white Europeans that live in Latin America.
Right. Very elite group in many countries, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, which are largely white. Why? Because they pushed the Indians out. The indigenous were pushed out or killed, or in the case of Argentina, massacred. Just massacred. And so what the Argentine government did, and this was back in the 30s and 40s, is to solicit a population from Europe, from white Europe. So they brought in, and particularly after the war, you're right, after the war, the Second World War, a huge push in the 50s, and to bring in white Italians, white Germans, certainly white English, and they came in hordes and populated the country, and really took over the haciendas, the very rich plantations, this marvelous, because she is marvelous actress, she's really quite talented. It was Argentine and was declared at one point for winning her Academy Award, the first person of color. Now, it was ridiculous because she was 100% English background, 100%. And nobody was more embarrassed than she was. And she had to step up and apologize many times that she was, you know, not a person of color. She was actually 100% English and spoke English perfectly, which was the reason why she could do films as easily as she was. This is a huge issue, because you find it, for instance, universities taking in students, and they're largely white, they're largely from that elite class, and then they can declare that they have a Latino population, right? Because they have these whites from Argentina or from, you know, you name it, because there are whites, you know, Latino whites everywhere. Those who can truly call themselves people of an indigenous background with deep roots in Latin America, or Afro-Latinos, who are many because of the race mixing over the years, suddenly there is this ruse that, you know, Latinos are being hired, when actually it's not representative of the typical big populations and the ethnicities that are parts of the American continent South.
As I said earlier, one of the things I like about reading your book is learning things I never knew before.
Oh, good.
So I didn't know about Juan Rodriguez, a Dominican who sailed up the Atlantic coast and stepped into the verdant shores of Manhattan Island in the spring of 1613 to become the first person of non-Indigenous to live in New York City, the first person of African descent, the first Black, indeed, the first non-Indian to settle, and I'm quoting you directly, in the future United States of America. How did you discover Juan Rodriguez? All the history I've read over the years that I've heard of Esteban.
Dominicans are very proud of Juan Rodriguez, and they should be. I mean, this was 1613, you know, this was 1610, 1613. He has been sort of, who knows whether he was kidnapped or recruited onto a Dutch ship. For his language abilities, he was able, he knew tribal languages, he could speak Dutch, he could speak Spanish, he could speak any number of languages, and he was a very, very quick learner of North American Indian languages. So he was very useful to the Dutch, and they would put him on the boat and they would, you know, go around to get their fur trade to shoot their raccoons or whatever they were shooting to send the fur back to Europe. And so here is this fellow who has been taken from the Dominican Republic, brought up in a ship, and he actually persuades the Dutch to leave him there. And he says, no, I can do more good for you here than I can in Amsterdam. So leave me here. And so he sets up this incredible emporium of ammunition and guns and knives and everything to outfit the fur traders who are going in, and they have to work with the Indians because the Indians know best how to capture the animals that they need. So there he is. He's an intermediary, and I call him the first bodega owner because he's sitting there in Manhattan. Now we have, you know, thousands of bodegas in Spanish Harlem and all up and down the island. But he was the first, and he was, you know, a very enterprising Dominican guy, as so many Dominicans in New York are to this day.
Wow. Let's talk about the beginning of the colonization of South America, Central America. Ferdinand and Isabella, you write, their burning ambition was to establish a muscular Catholic Spain that would champion the church and its Pope and act as a knight protector in its evangelizing wars. Now, we all learned about Christopher Columbus and Ferdinand and Isabella funding his trip. He was an Italian in 1492 to the Americas. But there was also that war that Ferdinand and Isabella fought because the Muslims had been on the Iberian Peninsula since the 700s. And then there was just the basic execution. If you didn't reject your original religion and become Catholic, you were expelled or killed.
Correct.
And then, of course, historically, we all think about the Spanish Inquisition. So talk a little bit about what was the role of Ferdinand and Isabella in sort of sparking this desire to raise money by exploration to push forward the Catholic religion with explorers who, in a sense, sort of gave a wink and a nod to Catholicism, but for them it was really more about money.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing story because Spain, under Ferdinand and Isabella, was united for the first time. Why? It was a bunch of separate states, and Ferdinand finally was able to eject the Muslim domination in Spain. And the Muslims, of course, had an extraordinary, it's down in the southern part of Spain. The Ottoman Empire, the Muslim Empire, had come right through Africa, from the Middle East through Africa and up into Spain. And it had been for many, many years, as you say, the force the really ruling force in much of Spain. And Ferdinand, who was a favorite of the Pope and the Vatican at the time, was convinced that they had to get rid of the Muslims, get rid of the Jews, and really enforce Catholicism in a very military way. The Spain of those times, as you can imagine, which had been at war for a very long time, finally, to achieve this, first of all, it went into bankruptcy doing it. Second of all, it was, suddenly had this tattoo effect, this rule that you either had to leave or you had to be executed if you were anything but Catholic. So Spain itself was forced to be Catholic. At the time when Christopher Columbus came by and was trying to persuade the king and the queen to fund his exploration, it was almost perfect timing. Spain was broke. It needed gold. It absolutely needed gold. Believe me, when Christopher Columbus took off in his three ships, there was not a priest aboard. It was all about gold. It was all about that. What happened was then once Christopher Columbus got to the Caribbean, and he thought, of course, he was in Asia or near Asia or close to Japan, and which is why he called the Indians Indians. When he got there, he really didn't meet any grand civilization. Christopher Columbus never came close to anything more than a few parrots and a few tribes. But he enslaved and exterminated a lot of people in the process of trying to find gold. He found some pearls, he found some of this and that and a little bit of silver, but he didn't find the gold that Spain needed and wanted. And he actually died, Christopher Columbus died totally poor and totally disbelieved and in chains actually at some point of his life. But what happened after Christopher Columbus is that, and the fact that he was blamed for exterminating people, and some people in Spain got upset by that, Isabella especially got upset by that, then came the enforced rule that if you were Catholicizing people, if you were evangelizing people and bringing them to Rome, to the church, it was okay. As long as you told them that's what you were doing. So there was this ridiculous thing where soldiers would shout from like great distances. They would shout, "Surrender, we will respect you. But if you don't become Catholic, if you don't believe in the church, if you don't accept our evangelization of you, anything goes." And of course, the anything goes was they would be killed. They would be enslaved. After Christopher Columbus began this whole thing because of Isabella, that it was almost a ruse, really, that we were going to win souls in this enterprise. And so priests began to come in every expedition. And of course, to be fair, the church did build a lot of institutions in Latin America, but it was always marching alongside the conquest.
So where are we today with religion in Latin America, America? Because it's really changed. Originally, I think you write that about 90% of the Latin Americans were Catholic, but the evangelicals have made significant strides in sort of breaking into that. And how has that affected the politics of these communities? Because I live here in Texas, and we've seen the voting becoming more conservative, say, for example, in South Texas, as opposed to the assumption made because they were people of color.
Right. It's really remarkable, Hopeton. And Guatemala has turned almost completely majority evangelical now, which is a great switch. I mean, you're going from Catholicism to Protestantism. Now, I remember as a child in Peru, growing up in Peru, if you stepped foot inside of a Protestant church, you are stepping into Satan's territory, and you will lose your soul, and you will go to hell. There was that sort of scare factor. And now, of course, people are leaving. Let's be honest. Latin America is still the most Catholic place on earth, no question. But there is now in Brazil, I think it's getting close to 3 out of 10, 30% are evangelical. And remarkable, because what happens, if you're a door-to-door person who goes to sell firewood, or you go to knock on somebody's door to say, I'm a handyman, or, you know, you've got work for me, or I'm a landscaper, you've got work for me. The first question that many Brazilians ask is, well, you know, what's your religion? Because the rumors that have been bruited about are that if you are Catholic, you'll lie and steal and cheat and rape the women of the household, because you can always go to church and say, I've, you know, God forgive me. But if you're evangelical, you know, you will be honest, you will show up on time, you'll do the right work, you will not overcharge, all of these things that is now believed, you know, in Latin America as it becomes more evangelical. That it is an issue not only there, but it is an issue here. The evangelical church has grown by leaps and bounds in the United States of America among the Latino population. And it has been very, very successful. What it promises is, you know, not that the poor will inherit the earth, but that if you are evangelical, if you join us, if you work in the right way, if you are honest, if you are part of this community, and you will get good work, and you will thrive, and you will thrive. And that promise of thriving in this lifetime is very, very seductive. I mean, wouldn't you go for that?
The prosperity, which would you go?
Prosperity theology is what they call it.
Prosperity theology, right.
Right, right. And you see people like Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, who is extraordinary. I mean, he is such a winning personality, and he has now I think it's like 42,000 churches that is a part of his network, and it's a very lovely promise, evangelicalism. So it is winning Latinos in left and right.
I remember it happening in the Black community in the 70s. The name of the preacher was Reverend Ike.
Yes.
And he was preaching the prosperity theology at that point in time. But one of the things you do write in terms of social versus conservative versus progressive, you write, we may be social conservatives with a progressive streak, or
right,
the other way around. Progressives with the conservative streak. And are we too often trying to make these predetermined labels too strict, because there is just sort of a mixture? You may be conservative on abortion, but liberal on programs the lines between these two poles too thick, and there's just a lot more interaction going on there.
That's the problem with trying to categorize the electorate, the Latino electorate, because we're all over the place on so many issues. It's not this or that for us. It's not blue or red. We vote across the lines. We are, I think, more comfortable as independents, because the vote will shift. It shifts so easily. There's no sense of sort of dramatic participation on any one side, but and you're right. We're social conservatives. We're social conservatives. We stay within our family. We are very family oriented. Many of us are actually the majority of Latinos in this country is for reproductive rights. So, you know, whereas we may say, I would never have an abortion, we will not say, I don't want you to have an abortion. So that's the Latino, that's the majority, more than 70% of Latinos will say that. I may not want an abortion, but you have your own choice.
One of the biggest delights for me reading your book was to read about Roberto Clemente. He was of my time. I watched him destroy my Baltimore Orioles in the, I believe it was the 1971 World Series when the Pittsburgh Pirates beat the Baltimore Orioles. When he died tragically on a plane ride to bring relief from a something bad that had happened in another country, earthquake relief. But you talk about problems he faced in the major leagues, and he faced it from both sides as a Latin American player and as a Black Latin American player. And he Right. had quite a bit to endure.
Oh, my. Oh, my. And he was such a hero in representing both being Latino and being Afro-Latino. And he was so angered by his experience in the United States. He was so angered by the sheer humiliation of being on being put on a different bus because of his color and his African colleagues on the team, being put on a different bus, being not allowed to go into a restaurant, having to wait in the parking lot in the Black bus while the white people went in and ate, and then, you know, they would shuffle you off to some place to eat. And that was so humiliating and so extraordinarily, I think, radicalizing for Roberto Clemente. He was a gentle soul, a very noble soul in many ways. And he really resented the journalists making fun of his accent, for instance, where they wouldn't make fun of somebody who was totally, somebody who was white, was speaking totally non-grammatically or with an accent that couldn't be understood. You know, they would make fun of Roberto Clemente's accent, and that would just drive him crazy. And he was not shy about speaking up about it. Just a great, great man. A terrible, tragic loss, I think, to Latinos when he died, actually going to help and do hurricane
to Nicaragua.
To Nicaragua to help with the terrible devastation that was happening there. And but his memory lives on because people really do remember. I'm so glad you do, Roberto Clemente.
Yeah, I was just an incredible admirer of him, his incredible arm, his batting prowess, and the fact of what he was doing. And it's interesting because sometimes, you know, when you get these civic lessons in high school, you listen to what they say, the way things are supposed to be, and you're just consider yourself a normal American citizen until you learn that you don't always get those rights, all those protections that they write about in the books where they teach you. And it sort of, it can radicalize you to say, oh my God, this is the country. And I think this is sort of this ongoing battle right now in terms of, do we preserve the myths of how this country was started? You know, America's for all and freedom and just
right.
This myth as opposed to, you know, the reality of don't you think it's more important to accept the warts and not try to hide the horrific things that we've done in the hope that, because it seems like it's just in the hope that people would just forget what was done in the past and move on. That it seems like there's a lot of people who want us to just forget what happened in the past and move on. But I don't understand how you can support that when you want to teach history anyhow. You just want to teach history that's been, for want of a better term, whitewashed.
Yeah, absolutely. I am with you completely on that, Hopeton. You know, there's nothing wrong in my view with saying, look, these are ideals and fantastic ideals, the Constitution, the whatever you want to call it, the ideals, the American ideals that we have set forth as aspirational. But there is a very, very vivid and terrible past. I mean, who was it? Was it James Baldwin who said American history is longer, larger, more various, and more beautiful, and more terrible than anyone has ever said about it? And that is true because, you know, from the Latino perspective, you see, for instance, the real story of Manifest Destiny and the Westward Ho and the push west was actually robbing people's land. It was very much in the way that we can say Nazi Germany went into Poland or the Soviet Union went into Ukraine. You know, the American truth is that land was stolen all the way. The Spanish colonial empire, if you want to call it, went from California to Kansas, and from the Rio Grande all the way up to Colorado. Okay, so that all that land was Mexico's, and we just went in, and the American administration at the time said, you know, go take your stake and put it in the ground, and you know, build America. And the truth was, you know, it was let's go steal land, go take your families, let's steal land, and that's exactly what happened. So we need to understand that the Mexican population of this country began with a population whose land had been stolen, and that is so. It's extraordinary that when you have a Mexican veteran, Mexican American veteran who has gone to war, who has won Purple Hearts, comes back to his little town in Texas, and is not allowed to go into a restaurant, is beaten out of a restaurant. I mean, how I think it's important to teach that history, to teach that that stain on America, and say, look, we have work to do. We have great ideals. We have a great constitution. We have great aspirations. But here's the reality. And here's the reality, what we've been through. And this is not that, you know, we need payback, but just understand that that this is not something that should be purged from history books. It should be in there and studied for the future.
Just thinking about the 1844 Mexican-American War, James K. Polk purposely sent someone across the lines to start this war so we can force Mexico to sell us the land that they didn't want to sell to us. And of course, we made, was it the Treaty of Guadalupe?
Right.
The Treaty of Guadalupe, which of course we did not stick to the Treaty of Guadalupe. No. So our history, whether we're talking about the indigenous people in this country, the indigenous people in Latin America, there's a whole history of colonizing powers,
right,
not adhering to the treaties that they negotiate with the people they're working with. So I will tell you this, that this is an extraordinary book.
Thank you.
And this is something that I hope wasn't too difficult for you to do? What was the process of writing such a encompassing book?
Yeah, it a huge task, Hopeton. It's been the most challenging, difficult book I've ever written, to try to get everything in. You can't get everything in. You can only touch on things. You want to represent the diversity within this population. And that was a challenge as well. At the same time, in doing the 237 interviews that it took me to do, in going back and studying the history, in going, in contemplating my own part in this history, because in my In my lifetime, I have seen the Latino population go from 2 million to 64 million in my lifetime. It's an extraordinary thing. At the same time, I have met such really wonderful people in the course of writing this book. People who inspire me from every level. I mean, from the most humble, modest life in this book to the most illustrious professional life in this book. It is a very resilient people, an inspiring people, and I'm very glad to have written about them.
Talk a little bit about the discipline and the regiment you had to use to make sure you got this book done.
First of all, I had to leave my job, my day job, in order to do it. My publisher, bless their hearts, because they're really supporting the book in a very big way, and I'm grateful. Really wanted it sooner rather than later. You know, it usually takes me 5 years to write a good, solid nonfiction book. In this case, I had to do it in 2.5, so half the time. And I'm so glad that I did Silver Sword in Stone first, because it was like that backlog of Latin American history was there and allowed me to understand the difference between your American personality as a Nicaraguan to your American personality if you're Cuban or Mexican or Dominican. And that was important. So I had good help there. But yeah, it was basically shoulder to the grindstone the whole time.
How do you stay motivated? Are there times when your spirit is flagging, your energy is flagging, and you get your energy drink or your cup of coffee or your partner whispers some words of encouragement? How do you stay motivated?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I don't know. I think my mother got it right when she said, when I'm down and I'm thinking I'm old and I don't have the spirit or the strength that I had before, I get up in the morning and I say, "Hey, I'm crashing a party." Every morning she would say, "Hey, I'm crashing a party here." So I try to keep my mother's spirit alive by saying, "Hey, crashing a party here and got work to do, and on we go."
Maria Arana, author of Latinoland, A Portrait of America's Largest and Least Understood Minority. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much, Hopeton. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.